In the year 1843, the French archaeologist Paul-Emile Botta first opened the gate into the world of Old Testament history. Archaeology of Mesopotamia and Palestine and elsewhere was really launched to a great degree. And almost at the very same time that Botta was making his finds in the land of the two rivers, the rediscovery of the history of the Jews was beginning in the hearts of Europe. Leopold Zuns launched the first scholarly investigation of the past of the Jews from 1853 to 1875. The Jewish historian Heinrich Gretz also labored over the first comprehensive account. His History of the Jews from the Oldest Times down to the Present appeared in 11 volumes. But why? Why all this interest all of a sudden in their own history? Why was the world becoming aware and a rediscovery of the history of Jews was beginning to be imparted to the individuals in Europe and worldwide as such? We're going to discuss a little bit about the restoration of the Jews and the role the LDS Church played in that to some degree. Knowledge alone, of course, can banish ignorance and prejudice, and there are many indications that a turning point had been reached sometime prior to 1843. What had happened? What had stimulated the situation to turn? Of course, there are sins of omission and the committed crimes of 2,000 years, deeply rooted, need to be removed, cannot be overnight. What has been done can never be undone, but it must soberly and objectively be recognized for what it is, the long historical agony of the Jewish people. Only in confrontation can we sanctify the present efforts towards a new course. No other people has experienced quite like the descendants of the people of the book in the dispersion, the diaspora. The whole world has served as a backdrop for their destiny, from the Near East, Egypt and Africa, to Europe and America, India and China. When the Jewish people were expelled from the land of their fathers, they found the whole world a house of bondage. Only a few happy hours in all the 2,000 years have intervened amidst long periods of suffering. And despite all oppression and misery, without a state, a country of their own, defenseless, powerless, and without rights, this people has survived all storms and disasters. No threats of death have ever swerved them from their faith in God, and they survived, despised and persecuted down through the centuries, and yet they enriched the nations of the world by great cultural contributions. Neither Islam nor Christianity is conceivable without Israel. Have you ever heard of Jesus Christ, or Spinoza, or Marx, or Freud, or Einstein? These are all part of the members of that disfranchised people. Surrounded as it is by the nimbus of divine mystery, it constitutes one of the great enigmas of world history, for God revealed himself to this people. The continued existence of the Jews over eras of the most terrible persecutions is the greatest of miracles. 2,000 years of dispersal literally fulfilled the prophecy pronounced on Mount Nebo 3,000 years ago in the fifth book of Moses. Their history comprehends in its duration all our histories, which it actually preceded by a long time. In the morning, you should say, would it were evening. And in the evening, you should say, would it were morning, because of the dread which your heart shall feel and the sights which your eyes shall see, said Moses on Mount Nebo 3,000 years before Christ. Or 1,400 years before Christ. You shall become a har, a proverb, a byword among all the peoples where the Lord will lead you away. Their restoration is now history. It's a fact. Let's reconstruct some of it if we can and go back a little bit in certain details. Now, the books that I'm using here and will be referring to are all new within just a matter of the last few years. The Post-Biblical History of the Jews, the Diaspora by Keller, is one. The Tents of Jacob by Patti is another. And perhaps we can get a little insight into what happened and what was expected to happen. In Deuteronomy, Moses tells us, and the Lord shall scatter you among the peoples, and ye shall be left few in number among the nations. Never in all history, to no other people, to no other religion, has such a strange history been prophesied. No other prophecy has so literally been fulfilled as that made in the fifth book of Moses to the people of Israel. The immense narrative of the Old Testament comes to an end before their disaster, and the book of Maccabees finishes with its tale of the heroic struggle of the Jews for freedom, and then there's no Chronicles for 2,000 years. The Jewish people originally came into being outside of the land of Israel, and then received their inheritance only for a temporary period of time. One has to validate repeatedly and re-evaluate the chartered right of the Hebrew people to possess the land of Israel. Psychologically, historically, there's an imperative, and then there's also the failing, that little sack of land that they carried with them from the promised land, which was placed beneath the head of the dead in each of their coffins in a foreign land. There was a great covenant between the pieces. They were told they'd be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, right from the beginning, when they served as slaves in Egypt originally. The character of a charter validating the historic claim of the Hebrews for the possession of the land Canaan or Palestine, as we know it today, has reasserted itself in political tribulations in the last century. But something triggered it. Something happened before 1843, as we mentioned to you earlier. So we go back a little bit. There were three dispersions of the Jews. There was a great dispersion that occurred about the time of Jeremiah the prophet, the Persian dispersion, we might call it, and even one perhaps before that, with the loss of the 10 tribes, with almost a majority of their people vanishing into history. Nothing is known. What happened? Was it strictly a myth? The whole northern 10 tribes vanished into obscurity, and they themselves never returned. The great temple of Solomon was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, and the people depossessed and taken into the Babylonian exile. 42,000 of them were to return, with about 7,000 male and female servants to rebuild the temple around 516 B.C. The temple was recompleted and dedicated, the second temple, and it remained in and out certain difficulties and problems in the land itself under certain of their own personal autonomy until about the time of Christ. And not long after this second descent of Israel into Egypt, as we might call it, there was another. In the middle of the 3rd century before Christ, after only 2 generations of Hellenization, Greek had become the principal language of the Jews of Egypt. And this is important in noticing that about that time in Alexandria, their texts were translated over into Greek and was to become an important adjunct to their 2,000 years of exile. In the 154 BC, there was a splendid Jewish temple in Lower Egypt, officiated in by a priest from the high priesthood at the temple in Jerusalem. Another temple had been built also by the Jews in Egypt 500 years before Christ, destroyed by the Egyptians 412 BC, in which there are many parallels to modern LDS restorations. That brings us now to about the time of Christ, the Judean situation, a monarchy that had taken control of the situation. They were part of the Roman Empire. Now, circumstances occurred in the year 64 AD. There was a Jewish uprising centered in the northern part of Palestine, and that uprising, in the very first episode, achieved certain success, wiped out certain Roman contingencies. And as a consequence, the uprising then, after a brief period of what appeared to be success to throw off the Roman yoke, suddenly then came under the long and exterminating siege of the Romans. 3 emperors, beginning with Nero's suicide, had occupied Rome. Then Vespasian, responsible for some of the conquest of Britain, had become part of the commander and the activity to dispel the Jewish uprising. He returned to Rome to assume the control of the empire and left his son Titus to take care of the Jewish situation in Palestine. The Roman 10th Legion near Jericho began a situation in 69 and 70 AD, which was to result in one of the great Holocausts, second to only the one we recently experienced in our own lifetime. In 134 days, Titus laid siege to the city of Jerusalem. 1,110,000 Jews were killed in the siege. Maybe just a few historical aspects of that might be of interest to you. What happened there was tremendous. Never been equaled except recently. 20,000 Jews in Caesarea on the coast in an uprising, and part of the uprising were slaughtered. In a single day in Damascus, 10,000 Jews had their throats cut. 116,000 bodies were thrown over the walls during the 134-day siege. And over 100,000 young men were taken on a forced march back to Rome. None survived. Every young girl and boy under the age of 17 was sold as a slave, until they even depressed the entire slave market throughout the Middle East at that time. The Romans destroyed 985 towns and slew 580,000 people in the surrounding area. 11,000 perished in unbelievable prison camps, none the worse for what we knew about under Hitler's regime. 6,000 young men were taken to Corinth to start the Corinthian Canal, not finished until 1883. When I stood there at the canal in Corinth some years ago, and as a geologist and an engineer, I could understand what they must have tried to attempt to do with 6,000 Jewish slaves to dig that canal. The dispersion of the Jews then occurs at about that time. This is the Great Dispersion. Titus was effective in reducing the total Jewish population in Palestine to 8,000. Those who were not massacred and otherwise destroyed or killed left, going east to Persia, China, and elsewhere, north to Turkey and into Russian areas in Central Europe, over into Egypt, and then within a few short years, many of those in Egypt were also killed. And those who remained behind, the last contingent of them, was killed by General Silvia when he finished the mopping up operations by 74 AD at Masada. That's the general background in terms of the Great Dispersion and why it occurred and on what basis. There's not too many other details I think that would be pleasing to understand. With that Great Dispersion, they've been homeless ever since, wandering with pogroms and destruction throughout the years. Something happened in 1820. A young boy, Joseph Smith, went into a grove of woods and received a divine revelation, among which was an announcement that the people of Israel would be restored. In 1820 to 1830, this reoccurred in angelic visitation. And from 1830 to 1844, a whole series of additional prophetic utterances were provided. The Book of Mormon text of 1829, published in 1830 in March, contained many statements concerning the restoration of the Jews. 1830, a young Jewish convert was made into the church. His name was Orson Hyde. He was personally blessed by Joseph Smith the prophet. And in the laying on of hand episode, Prophet Joseph Smith announced to him that he would be responsible for going to Jerusalem and there on the Mount of Olives, dedicating the land for the return of the Jews. A remarkable situation. The Church of Jesus Christ had just barely been organized. It was hardly a matter of weeks old. And as the church grew, by 1840, Orson Hyde had assumed a position among the Apostolic 12 in an organization reminiscent found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, a Quorum of 12 among the Jews toward the time of Christ. Orson Hyde had a six-hour vision, 1840. That he would actually go alone and arrive in Jerusalem and would then dedicate the land for the return of the Jews. He saw much of the accomplishment, who he would meet, Jewish authorities he would meet in Europe and England and elsewhere. And then within a matter of a month or two in April, conference of 1840, he was called to go and dedicate the land for the return of the Jews. In 1841, on October the 24th, Orson Hyde built a little altar on Sunday morning. He arose before sun up, went out upon the Mount of Olives, and able to look down upon the precincts of the temple, the old temple area, the Mosque of Omar, built a little altar of stones, and then sat down, and when the first early light he was able to see, he wrote some of the portions of that first vision, and then the dedicatory prayer for the return of the Jews. Within several years, an announcement was proclaimed to the world. It's called the Proclamation of the 12 Apostles, April the 6th, 1845, a year after the death of the Prophet Joseph Smith. It contains these statements. And we further testify that the Jews among all nations are hereby commanded in the name of the Messiah to prepare to return to Jerusalem in Palestine and to rebuild that city and temple under the Lord, and also to organize and establish their own political government under their own rulers, judges, and governors in that country. For be it known unto them that we now hold the keys of the priesthood and kingdom, which are soon to be restored to the Jews. 1845. Who would have ever dreamed that such a thing was even going to be possible? A great and glorious and mighty work, says this document, is yet to be achieved in spreading the truth and kingdom among the Gentiles and in restoring and organizing, instructing and establishing the Jews. In gathering, instructing and relieving and civilizing, educating and administering salvation to the remnant of Israel on this continent, the Indians. In building Jerusalem in Palestine and the cities, stakes, temples and sanctuaries of Zion in America. And in gathering the Gentiles into the same covenant and organization. And instructing them in all things for the sanctification and preparation that the whole church of the saints, both Gentile, Jew, and Israel, may be prepared for the coming of the Lord. There were only 20 states when Joseph Smith was made a prophet and when this proclamation was issued. And here he is declaring certain things concerning the Indians and the Jews and the world at large. What would happen? Today, in our time, 1978, nearly all of it has been done. Why? And what motivation? Come then, he says, to the help of the Lord. Let us have your aid and protection. This is a proclamation to all governments, all nations, all countries, all kings, and all authorities. He says, let us have your aid and protection. It was not given. And your willing and hearty cooperation in this, the greatest of all revolutions. It was not provided. But it did happen, regardless. The sons and daughters of Zion will soon be required to devote a portion of their time in instructing even the children of the forest. Who could have announced, other than a true prophet, what would happen with the Indian situation? Now one stands in authority in the church. You cannot, therefore, he says, stand idle and disinterested spectators of the scenes and events which are calculated in their very nature to reduce all nations and creeds to one political and religious standard, and thus put an end to Babel forms and names and strife and war. And so this is yet to be fulfilled. Much is yet to be fulfilled in the document. He says, the Jewish heart shall expand with knowledge, wide as eternity, and his mind shall comprehend the vast creations of his God, and so will the Indian and the Gentile, and will comprehend the eternal purposes of redemption, glory, and exaltation which were devised in heaven before the four worlds were organized, but made manifest in these last days for the fullness of the Gentiles and for the exaltation of Israel. And a year before that, the prophet had yielded up his life as a personal testimony to the revelations he claimed to have received. Orson Hyde then accomplished several things. Let's just look into his life briefly, because as soon as he had dedicated the land for the return of Jews, that October the 24th, 1841, things began to happen within 2 years. The comprehensive development of the history of Israel that we just announced to you earlier began to be prepared. So all these things then were coming forth. In this great dream that he had, that six-hour dream, it mentions how he would call upon the wealthy and upon some of the great leaders in places of England and Belgium and Constantinople. And he did. He called upon them and visited them and sent them letters. They were totally familiar with what his efforts were about. He wrote a letter in one particular instance here, and where he states, to me it belongeth to show favor unto them who show favor unto you. Murmur not, therefore, neither be ye sorrowful that the people are slow to hear, but do as been told you. All things shall work together for your good if you're humble and keep my commandments, for it must needs be that all men be left without excuse, that a righteous retribution may be awarded to all. There were three things that were given Orson Hyde in which he was to accomplish in the instructions from the prophet. First, to the American people, a letter recommended interest in the Jews and their faith. Second, to the world in general, the letter announced that Orson Hyde was a faithful and worthy ministry of Jesus Christ, a Jewish apostle. Third, to all religious persons and all others wishing the goodness and happiness of mankind, to urgently help him and provide him assistance. Not many did. In his dream, he was to go alone. A person by the name of John Page was assigned with him, but he apostatized and left the church in New York. Orson Hyde arrived at the Mount of Olives alone. However, an interesting episode occurred in Philadelphia. Orson Hyde there mentioned, just before he was to embark, that he was going on a mission to Jerusalem to dedicate the Holy Land for the return of the Jews. He also mentioned that Mormon missionaries travel without purse or scrip and that he was looking for financial assistance for his mission. He discussed this with the direct intention of soliciting funds. The result, however, was more than he hoped for. At the end of his sermon, a stranger gave him a purse of gold and asked the one favor in return, that when he delivered his dedicatory prayer in the Holy Land, he would mention the anonymous donor in that prayer. A year later, on the Mount of Olives, Orson knelt in Jerusalem he remembered the donor. The identity of that anonymous donor and his fate seemed to have been discovered in 1924 when Nephi L. Morris was speaking in the tabernacle in Salt Lake City. He mentioned the incident of the stranger giving Arden Heith a purse of gold in Philadelphia. A few days later, Morris received a letter from John F. Beck, who reported that the stranger was his father, Joseph Ellison Beck, claiming that all our family knew very well that he did this generous deed. The whole Beck family, and particularly the father, had indeed been blessed. Orson also attempted to interview the president rabbi of the Jewish community when he was in London, Dr. Solomon himself, who had broken his leg, and there was a difficult communication there, but he says, aware, he wanted to show his love for the Jewish people and say that I, aware that I have written very plainly upon these points that have come within my notice. You believe me, sir, when I assure you that my pen is pointed with friendship and dipped in the fountain of love and goodwill toward your nation. The thoughts which it records are preceded from a heart grateful to the Almighty, that the time has arrived when the day star of your freedom already begins to dispel the dark and gloomy clouds which have separated you from the favor of your God. With total audacity, with absolute fervence and absolute conviction, he met with different places in Beirut, in Smyrna, in Constantinople, Vienna, and elsewhere, Jewish leaders, and told them their return was imminent. After 1900 years, who believed him? He says, on one occasion when he was suffering from the hazardous journey, a number of days I ate snails gathered from the rocks, while our vessel was becalmed in the midst of several small and uninhabited islands. But the greatest difficulty was I could not get enough of them. I was so weak and exhausted, I could not go on shore after the slightest exertion without even drawing on my boots. But this is past. He says, I'm now strong and well and have plenty to eat. This is in a letter that he wrote, partly pre-Pratt. His only complaint was he couldn't get enough snails to eat. Then when he arrived in Jerusalem, he noted that Jerusalem looked precisely according to the vision which he had received. He knew exactly where to go and what to do as he went inland from the coast. And then he says, yet, as I find myself here alone, even though Elder Page had been appointed to accompany me here, just as the vision had announced. And then he prophesied in his dedicatory prayer that they would never again be driven. He actually formulated some of his prayer from 1 Nephi 15 in the Book of Mormon, where it says, and it came to pass that I, Nephi, spake much unto them concerning these things. Yea, I spake unto them concerning the restoration of the Jews in the latter days. And I did rehearse unto them the words of Isaiah, who spake concerning the restoration of the Jews, or the house of Israel. And after they were restored, they should no more be confounded, neither should they be scattered again. With this confidence, of course, we can look at the present political situation in the Middle East. The Lord will preserve them. As late as 1876, the British Council reports that there were but 15 to 20,000 Jews in Judea. When Orson Hyde dedicated the land for the return of the Jews, there were 5,000. In 1900 years, the population of Palestine, where the Jews were concerned, had hardly varied, if anything, decreased since Titus of the Roman 10th Legion. But within a few years, within 33 years, the population had begun to increase. By 1876, it had grown to approximately 20,000. 20 years later, the same authority declared the number of Jews to be nearly 70,000. What was happening? Let's go back to 1829. The Book of Mormon proclaimed the restoration was imminent. It was going to occur. But something had happened in Europe that foretold one of the greatest disasters to the Jews. 1819. 1 year later, Joseph Smith was to kneel in a grove of woods, and angelic beings and divine beings themselves would announce the total restoration. But in Hamburg, Germany, the European Jews, German Jews, in 1819, created the Hamburg Reform Society, which deleted or altered the traditional prayers which for 2,000 years nearly had called for the ingathering of the exiles in Israel. Some later Reformed prayer books went further and eliminated from the ritual even such seemingly innocuous phrases as the remembrance of Jerusalem and the Holy City. And then the Pittsburgh platform of 1855 expressed the Reformed position more succinctly. This was going on among the Jews while Orson Hyde had knelt in prayer on the Mount of Olives. We consider ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community, and therefore expect neither a return to Palestine nor the restoration of any of the laws concerning the Jewish state. The adversary was doing his very best to try to eliminate the circumstance and the situation from the people at large. So let's trace that out a little bit more, because it has some very important things for us to consider. There was actually a movement by modernized Jews to assimilate, to take their identity and remove it. There had been for 1900 years at the Passover, next year in Jerusalem. Now they were going to remove it and forget it. After 1900 years of suffering, they were going to remove themselves from such a thing. And so there was religious differentiation occurring among the Jews themselves, a fragmentation right at the moment when the power and the authority and the command from deity had said, return. And all the provisions for that return was being laid. And they would return. And yet, they were willing to throw overboard nearly everything that in the past had given substance and sustenance and content under all the duress for all those years. Even languages were abandoned. Jewish mannerisms were carefully brought under control. The Jewish apparel was discarded. The traditional Jewish fashion of wearing one's beard and hair was given up. The ghetto was evacuated, and the study of the law was discontinued. And for this, the Gentile equivalents were substituted, in addition to which Gentile occupations formerly closed to Jews were eagerly adopted. From 1819, at the moment that the adversary could see what was going to happen with the Great Restoration, he was moving to try to eliminate the situation among the Jews. Rabbi Isaac M. Wise, in 1819, born in 1819, did more for establishing the Reformed Judaism in America than any other Jewish spiritual leader, and stated in 1854 that one of the basic principles of Reform was that whatever make us ridiculous before the world as it now is may safely be and should be abolished. They were ceasing to pray for their return. Now, the Reform movement had its disaster, of course. It had played a great role, of course, in certain divine ordained punishments. The Jews were in exile, which is part of the human scheme of things. They were in dispersion, which is also part of the divine scheme. But many had lost that vision. And then in 1871, at the Augsburg Synod of Reform Rabbis for Germany, in Austria, Hungary, Galicia, and Switzerland, a total of 52 delegates, they stated that the old Jewish political existence has passed away altogether and the Jews were incorporated into modern personalities. There's more to this, of course. You can evaluate it at your own regard because these books are available. And then in 1860, the American Reform Rabbi Samuel Adler stated that the first and most important step for such a Reform congregation is to free its service of shocking lies. Petition for the restoration of a sacrificial cult and return to Jerusalem? Forget it. That's what they were saying. He says, in the 1855 Pittsburgh Conference again, we consider ourselves no longer a nation, and therefore expect neither return to Palestine, nor a sacrificial worship under the sons of Aaron, nor the restoration of any of the laws. In 1907, David Philipson, historian of the Jewish Reform Movement, summarized the Reform point of view as follows. If the Reform Movement teaches anything clearly, it is a repudiation of the political and national aspects of traditional Judaism and the clear declaration that Judaism is a religion with a religious mission only. Therefore, there was an outright rejection of all historical and emotional connection with Zion. And then in 1841, and this is interesting, in the Reformed Temple in Charleston, North Carolina, on March the 19th, this country is our Palestine, they said. This city in Charleston is our Jerusalem. This house of God, our temple. Even the American Jews in a certain Reform movement were likewise subscribing to the same feeling. In accordance with these sentiments, resolutions were passed by several Reform conferences to the effect that all references to the return to Zion, to the messianic hope, to the rebuilding of the Temple of Jerusalem, and to the Jewish peoplehood must be excised and removed from the prayer books printed for and used by the congregations. The elimination of these traditional Jewish elements was considered so important that David Philipson, the historian of the movement, singled it out as the greatest accolade in describing the prayer book of the Jewish Religious Union of England in London, 1903, which he stated was like the most advanced reform books, all petitions for a return to Palestine and a restoration of the Jewish state and reinstitution of sacrificial work are excluded. Can you see what was happening? Can you get the picture? Now let's go back over here to what happened. There was also at the same time a rise of Zionism. Right after 1843, with a new increased interest in their history, in Russia, of all places, the Aliyahs began. Whole groups of people sensed an impelment beyond all history. And within a matter of a decade, groups from Russia were preparing to purchase and acquire land in Palestine and did return to start taking muddy, swampy areas and turn them into productive areas to survive. There was impelments in other countries too among Jewish elements to return. There was a whole Zionist movement. And then the Congress of the First Zionist Congress met in 1897 and the Central Conference of the American Rabbis as well. At the same time that these meetings were going on, again, the American Reform Movement declared its total disapproval of any attempt to establish a Jewish state. And then this statement was adopted unanimously, and it remained the majority position in the Reform Movement until the rise of Hitler. Now, this thing you might understand. At the Columbia Convention in 1937, the Reform Movement affirmed the obligation. Note the turnaround. 1937, because of something happening in Europe, they reaffirmed, contrary to all their 100 years of reform activity, the obligation of all Jewry to aid in the upbuilding of Palestine as a Jewish homeland by endeavoring to make it not only a haven of refuge for the oppressed, but a center of Jewish culture and spiritual life. Because the reform movement in Germany, by the Hamburg Proclamation, and the great reform movement that occurred among the Polish Jews, resulted among the Ashkenazi Jews a certain situation. The Jews were divided throughout the world in three groups, the Oriental Jews, the Sephardi group, who had mostly gone into Spain and then been kicked out and gone into Turkey and Greece and several other places, and then what they call the Ashkenazi Jews, European Jews. 1933-34, the Nuremberg proclamations of the Nazis. By 1944, 6 million Jews had been killed. The Reform Movement said, "We're not going back to Jerusalem." And they didn't go back. Most of the Ashkenazi Jews were murdered by Hitler. Those who subscribed in Europe to the Reform Movement did not go back. Those who returned to Jerusalem were the Oriental Jews in particular, and a few of the Sephardis, not many of the Ashkenazi, except those who had already by impelment began under the Russian Aliyahs. So maybe a little bit of reconstruction then of what happened there after 1841. Under the prophet Joseph Smith, the great and positive declarations and actual command issued to all the nations of the world was for the Jews to return. Unequivocal, the situation was such as they would, no matter whatever opposed them. In 1830, at the time, the interest of the return of the Jews to Palestine was being kept alive by very few, perhaps mostly by Christians at the time. And then the announcements of the prophet, an 1845 declaration after his death. In 1873, the first agricultural settlements were established finally in Palestine, mostly by the Russian Jews. They called themselves the Lovers of Zion. And then Theodor Herzl, whose brilliant gift enabled him to make a significant contribution. He was the one instrumental for the development of political Zionism. He was profoundly distressed by the anti-Semitism of the Dreyfus Affair in France. And although he preferred assimilation to the Jews, he had been a subscriber primarily and originally to the Reform Movement, he felt that a return to Israel was the only guarantee of national survival. It was true. Those who did not follow through and exercise that desire to return to Jerusalem did not survive. The first Zionist Congress was convened in 1897 at Basel, Switzerland. By 1904, Herzl is dead. But the growth of Jewish settlements in Palestine, due to the political movement of the Zionists, had now increased so greatly that by 1914, 90,000 had returned to Palestine. The political Zionists insisted that the granting of a charter was an essential prerequisite for colonization. This opportunity was prepared by World War I and the famous Balfour Declaration. This was a letter written by Arthur J. Balfour, British Foreign Secretary to Lord Rothschild, on November the 2nd, 1917, declaring His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. In December 1917, a Jewish general, Allenby, enters the city. There's now 55,000 Jews in Jerusalem alone. And it comes under the British mandate. And then, in San Remo in 1920, this became the instrument of the British international policy and was endorsed by the Allied powers. The agreement of San Remo permitted 300,000 Jews to immigrate and settle in Palestine. This created massive problems, of course. This is when the disturbance and the confrontation with Arabs began. There was a young individual before the turn of the century who was a Mormon, and he kept hearing about what was going on. There was the announcement in 1873, another group of Mormons went over to rededicate the land of the Jews. Things weren't moving fast enough, and so another group of apostles went over, and they rededicated again. And then they come back, and they were talking in sacrament meetings and different meetings and conferences, and he said, if I ever see the return of the Jews, I'll know it. The church is really true. And then he happened to be in Israel in 1920 when the San Remo thing was announced, and just two blocks away from his hotel, there was a massive riot that occurred when the Arabs, realizing now that there was going to be a state for Israel, possibility, a refuge area for the Jews, created a massive situation. Men were killed, and he barely probably escaped involvement in that riot. And the man was David O. McKay. By 1935, at the end of 1935, tremendous settlements had occurred throughout Palestine. Already, 2 years of destruction had occurred in Nazi Germany, of those who had subscribed to the Hamburg Proclamation. The Arabs were bitterly resisting Zionism, and in fact, since 1928, a whole series of events had occurred where the Arabs and the Jews were in constant confrontation. Then, especially in the period from 1936 to 1939, the army of the Mahdi and various other things occurred with the rising Arab bitterness. To reduce the strife, the British finally issued the White Paper of May 17, 1939, limiting Jewish immigration to Palestine. Then the Storm Group and other groups of the Jewish people were organized, including the Haganah. And the head of the Haganah, supporting Jewish return, was Yagil Yadin, the Jewish general, responsible for translating many of the scrolls. World War II atrocities gave renewed impetus to Zionism. There was great violence in Palestine in 1944. 1945, the police headquarters was blown up by the Jews. 1946, the King David Hotel. The Haganah and others were moving towards a confrontation with the world at large. British turned the problem finally, it became so severe, over to the United Nations. And then on the 23rd of November, Lake Success, there was unable to come to a decision to establish the Jewish state. 6 days later, November the 29th, 1947, the United Nations calls for a partition of the territory into a Jewish and an Arab state, linked in an economic union. Jerusalem was to be an international enclave under United Nations control. The plan was rejected by the Arabs. There was confusion and war, and a great deal of insurrections going on for the next 6 months. Then the British mandate over the territory was formally terminated. May the 15th, 1948, the Jews proclaimed the establishment of a sovereign Jewish state. The previous day, battles flared. Seven Arab nations declared war. And then, with the United Nations mediation, an uneasy truce was declared. Israel was admitted as a nation to the confrontation of United Nations on May the 11th, 1949, a year later. Ceasefire occurred. An uneasy truce and recurring wars has occurred through all those years. The unrest increased, however, once again in 1952, and tension increased. By 1956, Israel, Britain, and France invaded Egypt on the famous 100-hour war. That was the Suez Crisis, if you remember. That's what created the problem with the Nag Hammadi documents, discussed in another tape. There was a whole series of things, the assassination of the Prime Minister of Egypt, and because of the 100-hour war, which involved the British and the French, the British and the French both were depossessed from their great international stewardship in those regions since 1812, since the time of Napoleon. The Israeli objective was to destroy the raiding bases and to open sea communication to the Gulf of Aqaba, and all of you know the background from there on. Now, then another uneasy peace occurred, which lasted in 1967. Then you know the results of the 1967 war, and then, of course, the October war a few years ago. The revelation states simply that there will be agitation until the Jews lay the cities of Egypt waste and conquer from the Nile to Damascus. and then they will be able to be reinstated and rebuild their temple. That temple has not yet been rebuilt, but other things have happened throughout the years. So the 1967 June War and the October 1973 are still preparatory to finishing the proclamations made by the Prophet Joseph Smith, 1848. Now, several other things occurred also. About 4 years ago, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the president of the church, Harold B. Lee, went to Jerusalem. There had been a small period of time when missionaries were active in Lebanon and Jerusalem about 30 years ago, but there had been no official church capacity in Israel. They established a branch in Jerusalem with Dr. Galbraith and Twetness in the branch presidency, and the commission was given to get the Book of Mormon into Hebrew, to get the testimony of Joseph Smith into Hebrew, and to get and obtain an information center for the church, so that the church then could effectively take its role in the world movement that we were involved in with the return of the Jews. Then 2 years ago, last October, just before conference, President Kimball stated that the time for the Jews has arrived, and the preparation for the work and material and the gospel to be taken to the Jews had arrived. A Jewish convert in Las Vegas was told in his patriarchal blessing 13 years ago that he'd be the one who prepared the material for taking the gospel to the Jews. He was called in as the chairman of the committee, and he finished that work in October and November, a year ago. And within the short few months, the lesson material for taking the gospel to the Jews had been compiled and completed, and for about a year has been used from San Diego to Newhall. Some of these elders may be familiar now with that activity. I have a copy now of my Articles of Faith with the Star of David and Angel Moroni on it. And the first lesson is interesting. A prophet has come. In other tapes, we discuss the great prophecies concerning the Joseph ben Barakiah, who would be the forerunner of the Messiah, to whom Elijah would appear on Passover Day. And Joseph Smith, we consider to be that ben Barakiah. He fulfills nearly all aspects of the prophecy. Then the first lesson, the prophet has come. Second, he has seen the Messiah. Third, the Messiah is Jesus Christ. So the movement among the Jews now is going on in an extraordinary manner. There are many hundreds of Jews that went through the temple in Washington, D.C. and through the great things that were provided in New York, the exposition. And they have many, many referrals. There's no way you can solicit or proselyte in Jerusalem because of law. It's one of the areas with the greatest freedom, except you cannot proselyte religiously. The Jews themselves don't know really who has authority, because there's 32 different sects. When they all return from the dispersion, they all come back with different ideas of what had happened for 1900 years. So there's a disturbance there, but it's a foundation for perhaps great things. Well, Twetness then took the prayer of Orson Hyde, put it on a beautiful parchment about that size, in Hebrew and in English, and took it into Teddy Kollek on the ministerial level, who was the first mayor of Jerusalem in 1900 years. What an office to occupy. Can you imagine? Every year for 1900 years, next year in Jerusalem, and now Teddy Kollek is mayor of Jerusalem. Great. And he laid that down on the desk of Teddy Kollek, and when he unrolled it, he took a glimpse at it, and he's a huge bear of a man, and Twetness is just a little tiny man. He stood up, totally overwhelming Twetness. Twetness didn't want to expect, because he says, "I don't want that. I've got it memorized." He'd come to find out that others besides Teddy Kollek had had the prayer of Orson Hyde memorized for 20 years. Ben-Gurion, General Diane, and others. And he asked, "What do you want?" Well, the upshot is the beautiful picture on the church news a few months ago. A special place has been selected on the Mount of Olives for a memorial to Orson Hyde. A year and a half ago, Howard Hunter was in Jerusalem as areas were made available and plans were prepared for a memorial in Hebrew and in English commemorating the dedication of the land of the Jews for their return by Orson Hyde, a Jewish Mormon apostle. And what finally was concluded is a beautiful 5-acre plot of land on the Mount of Olives, very near where he must have made that altar, has been set aside as a park, and it will be dedicated. It was going to be dedicated this last fall, but because of the Jewish interest and their sympathies towards Mormonism and vice versa, and beautiful things have been in the Jerusalem Post here the last couple of years showing that relationship, the Jewish government asked the LDS Church not to dedicate the land for the Orson Hyde Memorial last fall, but rather, instead, join with them in the 30th anniversary of the return of the Jews this May in a joint work
of dedication in which they will participate. So that'll be done this May. And probably it'll be increased slightly. I've walked in that very vicinity and marveled at the circumstances surrounding the return of the Jews. I know many Jewish people. In my particular work, I'm involved with Jews from Miami to New York to St. Louis to Omaha to Los Angeles, all through. And it's fascinating to realize that among them they feel an inner impelment. Things are going on. They can't resist. The world can't resist it. No matter what happens nationally or otherwise, no matter how the efforts of Hitler to actually massacre one-third of the total world Jewish population in a matter of about a decade, no matter what has been instrumental in trying to thwart their purposes, the Jews are now back in Jerusalem, nearly 4 million strong. Almost one-fourth of the total Jewish population in the world are home. The restoration has occurred. Things have happened. And the role of all of these things goes back to a young boy in the marvelous little grove of wood where the prophet Joseph Smith knelt down as a young man in his teens and asked about certain things. The quandary is now over. There is a church filled with authority and power, ministering to the world at large. Glorious it is to be a member of that church which embraces so comprehensive everything in the way of knowledge, national movements, governments, unforeseen things, unpredicated except prophetically. And with it all, of course, is the great terror that occurred when at Columbus in 1937, here in America, they affirmed the obligation of all Jewry to aid in the upbuilding of Palestine as a Jewish homeland by endeavoring to make it not only a haven of refuge for the oppressed, but also a center of Jewish culture and spiritual life. But if we go back to that one little document that had been put out by the prophets and the others, it stated they would return. They would re-engage themselves with their own judges, their government, their offices, and fulfill all the things in their reinstatement, in their whole role as a restored Israel, preparatory to them receiving the gospel and the coming of the Messiah. Those events then that are yet to transpire are prophetically laid out in the Book of Mormon, in the Doctrine and Covenants. 1,600 prophecies were provided by the prophet Joseph Smith, 1,200 of which have been fulfilled, and a number of them apply directly to the Jews and their immediate future, and the temples that will be built there. The restoration of the Jews is just one example, and their return, that there is a prophet in the land, a restoration of all powers and authorities, and may each individual look into his own heart and examine the evidences that are provided in all the books that are available. In Christ's name, amen.